Cue Henry Mancini, please. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen. John Mack does some welcome you to the 271st episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 270 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, www.johnmack13.com. Artists in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is a weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mahopac Library on Route 6 in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. April is National Poetry Month, and it will be poetry readings sponsored by both the Mahopac Poetry Workshop and the Yorktown Poetry Workshop the week of April 7th. The one at the Mahopac Library is on Monday, April 8th, at 6:30 p.m. Readings by members of the Mahopac Poetry Workshop will be followed by an open mic session. Sign-ups for the open mic begin at 6 p.m. The Yorktown event will be at 2 p.m. on Saturday, April 13th, at the John C. Hart Library on East Main Street in Troubled, New York. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. I hope you'll be right back here at the same 7 p.m. Eastern Time next Sunday when we begin National Poetry Month with the discussion with poet M. Tofola, who also produces the monthly online newsletter and mailing, The Anagram, dealing with writing news and recipes. Now to this week's show, as mentioned, the 271st in the series. Tonight, Vincent C. D'Aquino, the founder of the aforementioned Mahopac Writers Group, returns to this microphone the night before his latest book, Patriot Hero of the Hudson Valley, The Life and Ride of Sybil Lovington, is released. In addition to being an author and the coordinator of the writers group, Vinnie, a retired teacher and wrestling coach, is a television host, a historian, the coordinator of the writing groups for veterans and young adults, and a close friend. His published works include histories and young adult fiction. His brand new book is actually the second book on Sybil Ludington. I'm very pleased to have Vinnie join us tonight before the release of his new book. He has an extremely full schedule of events in April, and they relate him to the book, including the presentation to the Yorktown Town Board on April 2nd, readings at bookstores and historical societies, and acting as the featured artist at the Hudson Valley Writers Center in mid-May. The listeners wishing to join Vinnie and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold caller participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Okay, let's get started. Welcome to the show, Vinnie.
Hey, Alan, John, glad to be here. It feels strange to be on this side of the interview. Usually you're on my TV show, and I get to be the host.
That's correct. Speaking of everything else that you do, let's do a quick background on you before getting into the book. But where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
Well, I actually grew up in central New York, in Utica, New York. The snow belt of the world, it always seemed, anyway.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
do you remember what your earliest...
I grew up in Utica, and then I left Utica and went to Mercy College, right in Dobbs Ferry. And once I hit Dobbs Ferry, I never left Westchester until I moved to Putnam County. And now I've been in Putnam County in Mahopac since 1986.
I went to Mercy, and then I know that you got into teaching. Could you go directly into teaching after Mercy?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I student taught in Ardsley, New York, and I was very fortunate, because after I student taught, they asked me to stay on. So I did. I stayed on for 15 years. And then I went on to Pelham, where I stayed for 20 more years. So then I finally retired from teaching. When I was at Pelham, I actually taught classes for 15 years. And then I taught teachers for the last 5 years. I ran a teacher center. I was a director of teacher education for 5 years.
Where were you the wrestling coach? I know you were also
in Ardsley. I was a football coach first and then a wrestling coach. And I remained a wrestling coach while I was at Ardsley. And then they began a middle school in Pelham. And Pelham had a junior high, and they were going to transition. Now, because of declining enrollment, I had gone in Ardsley to the high school. And although it was nice and I did like it, again, I was hit by declining enrollment, and I moved on to Pelham. And instead of sports, I was drama director. So I served as drama director most of my time there at Pelham, which was very interesting. It was a change for me, but it was a challenge and a very welcome challenge.
What led you to form the Mahopac Writers Group?
When I was at Pelham, I formed a group called the Peanut Butter and Jelly Writing Academy as part of the teacher center that I eventually took over. And the Peanut Butter and Jelly Writing Academy was simply a group of students who gathered around a table after school, ate peanut butter and jelly and cookies, and wrote. And it was at that time that I realized the importance of working with writers and how important it is for writers to have feedback. You know, it's like kids gathering in the driveway, learning how to play basketball by working together informally. And that's exactly what the Hopak Writing Group has been. We brought food, and we brought chips and whatever. And since 1997, I've been there. I was working on my first Sybil Ludington book, and they asked me to go there and do a talk on Sybil Ludington, and I did. And when it was done, they said, "Hey, do you think you could kick off a writing group for us? A number of people in the community were interested in writing." And I said, "Sure, you know, I'll kick off a couple." Well, I've been kicking for 20 years. So it's been interesting. And there's been so many good writers that have come out of there, people who were totally shy and unsure of themselves, and they just came into their own.
I've been struck particularly the last couple of years as the three women who come to mind have been very open about tragedy in their lives and grief and other things, anger after a husband died. And I was spoken about this publicly, and it's amazing the trust that people show in others in the group, that they're willing to open themselves up like that. And I know that you said that you think it's as much a family as it is a group. Do you want to just speak about that for a minute?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that really is the key. The key is that it's a non-threatening environment. They have the opportunity to get out there and say the things that they've been keeping inside for years. And in many ways, writing is therapy. You know, when I had my master's degree, I had to decide what topic I wanted for my thesis. And I immediately went to bibliotherapy. And bibliotherapy is therapy through books. And not only through reading books, but writing books and even poetry. And I preached for a long time poetherapy, and that's to get inside yourself and write some of those things that drive you. And people are able to put their thumbs on the things that matter. And you've heard a number of them. We have a young man in there with OCD, and this kid had serious situations as he was growing up. And he was able to open up about all of those, and the books he's produced and the poems he's produced has really created another side of him that he didn't even know existed. And the group has not only been gentle with understanding where he was coming from, they were with him all the way, and he's grown so much through his writing, and we've grown as writers, hearing his writing. And that's what it's all about. It's a community. It's a family of writers, people who think alike. Often in life, we have good friends, dear friends that we've had for years, but they don't always think the way we do, and their passions are not always our passions. So it's important to find people with like thoughts and like passions, and that's what the writing group is about. Some of these people have never seen these people before. They come into the writing group, this is the first time they meet these people, and before long, they're confiding in them, and they're sharing inner secrets and thoughts. And some of it is absolutely wonderful.
On the passions, I'm not sure that on many things we all think alike, but I think they're all committed to writing, to improving both our writing and the writing of the others around us.
Yeah. You're right about that. Some of them are very different in many ways. They come from all different walks of life, but they do. The thing that they have in common is the understanding that when you put your passion on the table, you are fragile. And what happens is you're exposing yourself to others. And it's dangerous in many ways, because if you don't have a group that understands where you're coming from, it could be frightening and it could be harmful. So we tread lightly, and yet the goal is always to help the writer be the best writer that he or she can be. And they all understand that, and they're careful. Now, I'm not going to say that there haven't been times that, you know, we had to say, whoa, you know, what you really mean to say is the writer could have improved a little more in this area or that area. But generally, what a great chemistry of people. They're people who get it, and that's why people come week after week after week. This is a weekly group. We've been doing this weekly now, all of 21 years. It'll be 22. And people just keep coming because it's where they need to be in terms of their head. Not physically, but mentally and spiritually.
You mentioned during the conversation your master's. Where'd you get your master's and in what?
Well, I actually got a master's in reading diagnostics and difficulties. I was a reading specialist, but my degree, again, was in master's thesis was in bibliotherapy. And the whole idea that in reading, you can actually help people be better readers and better people through literature. And if you can help them put their finger on some of the things that are important to them. So I created an entire bibliography of books that would help in all kinds of situations, diabetes and bullying and divorce, peer pressures. And when I was teaching, I would direct my students to those books that I felt would help them be better people and get through rough times in their own lives.
Now, was that also at Mercy or was it someplace else?
No, that was at City College.
Oh, in New York, okay.
Yes, CCNY.
And what about the television show? How did that come apart? How did that come about?
One of my writers from the Mahopac Writers Group took a course on running a studio, and Comcast was offering a sort of a payback course for the community. If Comcast was going to use the airwaves of Putnam County, then they should give back to Putnam County. So what they did is they said, all right, all this wonderful equipment we have here, the studio, the cameras, all the equipment here, the community is welcome to use them, but they have to take a course to learn how to do it. Once they take the course, they're welcome to the studio. So Linda Shaw, one of the writers, came to me and said, hey, Vin, you know, you work with so many writers, and I think the community would be very interested in hearing you work with a writer on the air. Would you be willing to do that? And I said, sure. So I took one of my writers, and she came on the show, and we did a show, and everyone said, wow, that was great. Would you like to do another? Well, one led to the other, and that also has been going on for now, I think, almost 7 years. I did 100 episodes of Let's Talk Writing, and it was basically just writers. And then after the 100 shows, we said, you know, there's so many wonderful writers out there, so many possibilities. I mean, non-writers, but people with passions. So I decided that what we needed to do was a show that was basically people and their passions. And it was called One-on-One with Vin DiQuino. And I started bringing in people from all walks of life, people who were working with vets, people who were working with cancer patients, people who were working with horses, and a horse orphan ranch. And just one by one, all these people started to almost come out of the woodwork. So now we've done 139 shows of Let's Talk Writing. I mean, of one-on-one. So altogether, well, I have about 239 shows in the can.
How does one get to see the past shows, Vin?
YouTube. All you have to do is go on YouTube, put in One-on-One with Vin DiQuino, and they'll all come up. The other way is to go on my website, and that's www.vtdaquino.com, and they'll all come up, including, I believe you did three of them, right?
I have over the times, yes.
Yeah.
How about the veterans group? How did you get involved there?
My son is a Marine, and the veterans were really great for him. And at one point, my son was talking to John Borges, who runs Vet to Vet, a great program of vets working together with vets. And he said, you know, would you be willing to help some of our vets who want to be writers? And I said, would love it. What an opportunity to have them get inside themselves and unload some of those things. I mean, some of them carry their memories like baggage, and some of it's just too heavy to carry. So every first Wednesday of the month, we get together, and we do pretty much a writer's circle, the same thing we do at Mahopac Library, and they talk about some of their experiences. Now, at first, I thought we were restricting our writing to their veteran experiences, but it's not. It's branched. One writer, for example, had a very difficult time with his dad when he was growing up, and his dad had some very serious mental and emotional difficulties. And he wrote about all of these fears and things that he had to deal with in his youth growing. So we don't restrict it just to veterans, but we do talk about the importance of trying to get inside yourself and deal with some of these things that are hurtful, painful, and part of their growing of age.
For the audience, John Borges, who Vin mentioned, has been on the radio show. And it's interesting where this group came from. There was a very short time during the Iraq War that a member of the armed forces, I'm not sure if it was the Marine or an Army man, from Long Island, Joseph Dwyer, rescued a young infant that was in the middle of a combat zone out. To get out, he exposed himself, and he brought the infant to safety. And that was captured on television. So a very, very short time, he was a hero. Well, he came back to Long Island, and he eventually became addicted to drugs and committed suicide. And there was the feeling by people who knew him that if there was someone that he could speak to who had similar experiences. You can't always talk about things like being in combat with a person who's been an English teacher or a basketball player or whatever. So they formed this vet-to-vet group in one of the Long Island counties, either Nassau or Suffolk. It's the vet-to-vet program, Joseph E. Dwyer. Since then, it's spread to counties and to jurisdictions all over the East Coast. And one of the most active ones is in Putnam County, where many mention, and John Borges is the local director. And I participated in two writers' weekends around Veterans Day starting last year, or the year before last. They take over the gallery for three Saturdays. One is the art of the veterans. One is the writing of the veterans, and another is the music of the veterans. And the Vinny hosts the writers one, and I participated in the last two, and it's extremely moving. Particularly.
Oh yeah.
The first year that I was involved, there was a woman who had some physical difficulties. And she got up and she read to what she had written. And it was extremely moving just seeing her fight the battle to get her words out and to get her thoughts out.
Yeah, that's
do you remember
true.
Her, Vin?
So it's really a very important thing. You know, as I say, writing is therapy. And that's why I enjoy working with writers. I also work with young adult writers from all around the county in two ways. One is through the Rotary. We do a book called On My Mind, and these students submit work, and some of the work is just mind-boggling. And every year, Northeast Westchester Rotary out of Somers produces this book, and then in May they have what they call their book launch, and I've been very fortunate to be their speaker for the program, and they bring all these kids in, and they have at least one kid from each school get up to the microphone and read his or her work, and it's just fabulous the work that they produce. The other thing I've been doing for about 20 years is BOCES has what they call their Young Adult Conference. And every year they do the same thing. They bring in kids from all over the area. They had 370 or so high school students in March. And they brought these students in, and they brought about a dozen of us writers, editors, lyricists, and then the students choose which workshops they want to go to. And they go to 3 70-minute workshops in that morning. And they go from writer to writer or, you know, journalist, and they learn about writing. And it's just a terrific program, and it reaches out to young writers. And it's so difficult sometimes to help writers with promise in a classroom situation because there's a curriculum to follow, and there just isn't enough time and room and space to work with the creativity that some of these kids have. And they just need more.
You and I have talked about that with my field, which has become poetry, and it's your feeling that it's very often the teachers who ruin poetry for the young children, and in many cases they never get it back.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I've often been upset when, you know, I face my classroom and say, well, guess what our next unit is? Poetry. And they go, oh. And you go, you know, and I say, wait a minute, what do you mean, awe? You know, and I have to show them that there's different approaches. Unfortunately, poetry has had a bad rep, you know, and kids get turned off, and they don't understand that poetry is so much, you know, and it's dealing with how you relate to others in terms of emotions and feelings. And it could be funny, it could be sad, it could be political, it could be long, it could be short, it could rhyme. It's so many different things depending on who you are as a poet. And again, unfortunately, our curriculum doesn't allow the time it takes to really get a student to appreciate how wonderful poetry really is and how important it is to you as a whole person.
It was ruined to me for a long time.
Yeah.
Now on to your writing. What was your first book?
My first book was Kiss the Candy Days Goodbye. It was a bibliotherapeutic approach to diabetes. I had a young boy on my wrestling team who didn't want to wrestle. He wanted to be the manager of the team. That means he had to wash the mats and give out equipment. And I said, Josh, you know, buddy, you really should be wrestling. And he said, I can't. And finally, it took a while, he admitted that he had diabetes and that he gave himself injections. And he felt that because he had diabetes, there was no way he could wrestle. He said to me, you know, listen, whenever kids have problems, you have books to give them. Do you have any books to recommend to me for diabetes? And there wasn't any that addressed exactly what Josh's situation was. For one thing, the books that I had seen on diabetes were more for girls than boys. And I needed a boy's book. So I wrote this book about a wrestler who had diabetes and how he had to overcome this special difference that he had. You know, when I see an affliction of a kind, I like to call that a special kind of normal. And that's just what Josh was. He was a special kind of normal. And because of that, he had to do some things differently. And there's a place in the book where the doctor approaches him and says, you know, you're not going to be like all other kids. There are things that you're going to have to do that other kids won't have to do. And it's important that you understand that special kind of difference. And he said, I don't want to be different. And she says, you know, it's not being different. It's learning how to deal with your difference that's going to matter. And that will make all the difference in the world for you. And, you know, it's a theme that I've always understood, that everyone's different in one way or another. So I wanted to incorporate that theme into the book. And that was my first book, called Kiss the Candy Days Goodbye. The main character, Jimmy, used to go and have candy days with his best friend, Margaret. They'd buy candy from a vendor at the park and then go spend the day in the park and eat candy. And he thought that he would have to kiss those candy days goodbye. And in reality, he didn't. He just had to know that when he ate a candy bar, he had to adjust that in his diet. And there were things that he would have to do that were different from others. But we're all different in one way or another. So my first book was a bibliotherapeutic approach to helping kids with diabetes, kids like Josh.
Now, I know that you've written both fiction, mainly of the young adult, and nonfiction. Why don't you take us through the fiction first, any other fiction books?
Well, there's a number. I have about eight fiction books. One, Return of the Cicada, is also bibliotherapeutic in a way. It's a story about a young boy who developed AIDS he had the HIV virus through a blood injection, a blood transfusion, when he was in a car accident. And it's a story of how a girl who was having emotional difficulties in school and just having a real tough time getting along in school befriends this boy and helps him get through a very difficult time. Again, that was called Return of the Cicada. I did actually a couple books on death, facing death of a classmate. And Mary Loved Daisies was based on my first experience as a teacher of losing a student. I did have a student named Mary. This is not her story. This is completely fictionalized, but the whole idea was based on the fact that Mary, in eighth grade, died when the boiler in their basement malfunctioned, and she was overcome by smoke and died. Well, I created an entire fictional story. What if she had a wrestler boyfriend, a young eighth grader, who is in pretty much first, I don't want to call it puppy love, because in the book I make it clear that they're not puppies, and they are in love. But he loses her, and he has to deal with this idea of death, and he goes through all of the stages of grief. And I worked those stages of grief into the novel the same way I worked all the symptoms of diabetes into the Kiss the Candy Days book, so that they're reading a story about kids their age, kids that they can identify with, but they're also learning about the situation that those kids are in. And some of those kids reading the books either might have that situation themselves, or they might have classmates who have that situation.
Now, you've just come back with what you're working on now as a fiction book to Jimmy and Mary. Have you not?
Yes, I have. I've developed a type of poetry that's a novel, and they're called diary poems. And what I did is I developed an entire novel based on 10-line poems, non-rhyming, and there's 10 poems to a section, 3 sections to a chapter, and then 6 or 7 chapters to the book. And the whole book is written in that form. Another book I did that way is called Emails to a Paranormal. And for a while, I was very much involved in paranormals and life after death. And that became a major theme for me. So I did write Hauntings of the Hudson River Valley, which is about hauntings.
Now you're into nonfiction.
I'm into nonfiction. You're right. And before I got into Hauntings of the Hudson River Valley, I met a girl who my daughter used to complain that she had sibling rivalry with, and the guidance counselor was very surprised to find that she was having sibling rivalry with a girl who died in 1839 and did a famous ride in 1777. My daughter was growing up right at the time while I was working through this book, and I had sort of met Sybil Ludington on a road sign on my way to school, and I had no idea who she was. And by the time I got to the library, and by the time I read all about her, I was so engrossed in it and amazed that much of her information was just absolutely not clear. And it seemed that it had to be erroneous. For one thing, it said that she had 6 children, 4 boys and 2 girls. I went to 22 cemeteries looking for those kids. They weren't there. No school records, no death records, no birth records, not even names for any of these kids. And yet, we were teaching children in the school that she was the mother of six kids, and that she married a guy named Henry or Edward or Edmund. It depended on the article. Some called him Edward, some called him Edmund. There were just so many inconsistencies in her story, and it just drove me nuts. And
now what is claim to fame? How did you get interested in her to begin with?
Well, again, I was on my way to school and saw this sign, went to the Mahopac Library, and one of the members of our writing group who has been there from the very beginning was Andy Campbell. And Andy Campbell was a clerk at the library, and he pulled that file for me. And, in fact, he kind of nudged the library when he knew that they were looking for someone to do a writing group. And he said, hey, this is the guy. And we ended up becoming best friends, and we've been friends ever since. He in fact, is even a cameraman for the TV show.
Right.
So he's
a very good person. But what did Symbol do? I mean, we just pointed out.
What I discovered was, first of all, amazing. She was a 16-year-old female hero of the Revolutionary War. I didn't even know there was any such thing. For years, we never heard about female heroes. You know, I went all the way through school thinking that, you know, heroes were all white males, you know. And, you know, we've come a long way. We're not quite there yet, and my new book will prove that. But I was just amazed that she, on a night in 1777, the British landed at Campo Beach, which was near Norwalk, Connecticut, today, with 2,000 men. And General Tryon, who was the royal governor of New York, took these men all the way up to Connecticut, terrorized the Connecticut countryside, and landed at Danbury. His goal was to go there and burn the Patriot supplies, and he did. And there were barrels and barrels of supplies and blankets and shoes and just all kinds of things. And he burned them. Well, in the middle of the night, they sent out in all directions to try to get help. And New York, where Sybil lived, in a place called Fredericksburg, was about 20 miles from Danbury. So a messenger went out into the night, a rainy 9 o'clock Sunday night, and went to the house. Now, I imagine that the family had to be terrified because Colonel Ludington, her father, had 400 men, and he had to be ready on the quick to go out whenever there was any kind of turbulence, and there was a lot. I have pension records that I was able to dig up to show that he was called out on an alert often, and he had to go out, get his men, and go off to wherever there was. And that night, the messenger came and said, we need your 400 men. Danbury's burning. And 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, he was militia. His men were on their farms. So there was no way that he could go, because once they gathered at the house, he had to be there. Someone had to be there to organize these men. There was no one to send. Sybil got on her horse, went out into the night. Now, this new book has changed some of what I had said in The Call to Arms, which was my first book. It was called Sybil Ludington, The Call to Arms. And at that time, we believed that the first mention of her ride was 1907, and that it was in the memoirs of Colonel Ludington. And writer of that book, Willis Fletcher Johnson, was paid by two Ludingtons, a brother and sister, and there was an article that was written in the Connecticut Magazine by Lewis S. Patrick, who was actually the son of the daughter of one of the colonel's brothers. So people said at that time, oh, well, you know, those were relatives, and that's why they wrote the story. They wanted to make their relative look good. Well, after that book was published, and I did all kinds of fighting for her, a wonderful thing happened. We found out that in 1880, there was another mention of the ride by a very famous historian, only it was in a book called History of New York City, and Origins of the History of New York City by Martha Lamb, who was a very well-known and well-respected historian. It was, I put this book together. It took me about 3 years to get Call to Arms together. I found pension papers, and by the end of the 3 years, it was clear she was not the mother of six kids. She was the mother of one boy. His name was Henry. Now, today, more and more people are saying, yeah, she was the mother of one, and a lot of them are repeating what I was able to find back then. Now, again, I didn't create the story. All I did, I am a researcher, and my job is to go out and try to find every piece of her story that I can and put it together. And for Call to Arms, that's exactly what I did. I just went out and got every single thing. Anytime anyone said anything about Sybil, I took it and studied it, tried to put it together with the whole pieces, until finally I created what was called A Cradle to Grave, a story of Sybil from her birth to her death. And that was in 2000 that book was published. Well, last year, my publisher, Purple Mountain Press, said, you know, it's had a wonderful long run, but I don't believe I'm going to reprint. So, according to our contract, it allowed me to have the rights reverted to me. And I had to decide what that meant. You know, do I just let it go? So I thought about it, said, you know, do I have anything really different from what I had before? So I went back and I looked online and I saw that many of the things that I thought I had corrected were being repeated again, that the internet was bringing up some of those old things, and some people were still saying she had six kids. And not only that, I found other errors, and I said, this can't be. And, you know, Sybil was just haunting me to just get the story right, especially she had a grandson who was a hero, gave his life saving women and children. No one even knew who this kid was, and it was just wrong. So I had to straighten all that out again. When I went back to the drawing board, I discovered that there was a box of letters, family letters, correspondence, dating all the way back 1800s, and this was new material. And it was important because when I went and found these other errors, I found four frightening things in terms of Sybil's story. One, people were now saying that she was merely a legend, didn't really exist. She was made up. Number two, the Danbury expedition was purely Connecticut. Her father had nothing to do with it. Three, the battle was insignificant. It really was not a very important battle. And four, Sybil never rode. Well, I couldn't stand for any one of the four of those, and I had to get back to the drawing table. And that's what helped me to discover these records that were right there, donated in 2015 by Jane Ludington. And they're sitting at the New York Historical Society. So I went and spent hours and hours and hours and days going there and going through all of these boxes. And they're wonderful correspondence. What happened was that Jane Ludington discovered these in a carriage house in a former Ludington mansion. They had a carriage house that had like filing cabinets downstairs. She went through them, and there they were, yellowing. She was even concerned that mice were getting in there. So she took them all and donated them in 2015 without really saying anything to anyone. So I was able to find these and go through them carefully. And I was able to piece together more of Sybil's story. So the result was I created a new book called Patriot Hero of the Hudson Valley, The Life and Ride of Sybil Ludington. And this is a book with much more document than the other had. Although I'm not saying that I didn't have documentation in there. There's some pretty heavy documents that prove who Sybil was. And that's really what my goal was. It wasn't really to prove that Sybil took that ride that night and that was her big, her defining moment of her life. Well, it was the defining moment of her life, but it defined who she was as a daughter, a mother, a wife, a grandmother, a businesswoman. She was an amazing woman. And people were ignoring that. They were trying to see only the ride. Well, I could almost buy that. But then when they started saying that she didn't even take the ride of someone's imagination, that she was being created because people needed a hero. Sybil was a hero. And she was a hero on many different planes. And I had to present her as the woman she really was and really is. So that's what this book is. And it contains, and I attacked all those four things. They said that her father was never involved. Baloney. I have pension records, sworn oaths, sworn documents saying they were with his regiment that night, the night that David Wooster was killed. I have a letter from her father's grandson, her nephew, from 1854, describing the ride and how she saved her father's life. 1854. Never have we gone that early in her life. It was believed that 1880 was the first mention by Martha Lamb, but she never gave sources for her story. I have those sources, and those sources are in the new book. I have a letter to Martha Lamb from Charles Henry Ludington, 1854, it was later, and on the it was 1878, and on the top of that letter it says, to Martha Lamb. And it's like her story. It's the information that she had to create her article. So now I think I've taken readers much, much closer to the reality of her life. I believe that the book will help us understand that she did live, and she really lived. And she's the kind of person that great Americans are made of. She has the courage, the determination. She's a role model for men and women alike. And she lived in a time when women did not get the respect that they deserved. And when a woman got on a horse and rode 40 miles through the countryside. It was expected. And she was not considered a hero for doing it. They wanted to know where the men went after they were called out, not who called them out. And yet when she rode out at 16 years old, she had just turned 16 3 weeks before the ride. When she went out on that ride, she took her life in her hands. There was a wonderful chance that she would never return. Her father was a wanted man. And the cowboys, the Skinners, and the British wanted him dead. And there was a reward offered for his head. If they knew that that was his daughter out there on the horse, she never would have made it back. So,
yep. The book comes out tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning is the first day. I saw the first Thursday. But I've got to tell you, you want to know why my passion is as strong as it is? Get this. Yesterday, I went online, and I looked up Sybil Ludington. And I was very pleased to see that an article that was written in the Mahopac News about me, a full-page article, is now online. But, John, you're not going to believe this. Underneath the article was another article about that a woman had written saying that she read Patriot Hero of the Hudson Valley, and in that book I said that George Washington went to her house to thank her. That is not true. I don't know for sure. I mean, part of her legend, quote unquote, was that George Washington went to the house to thank her for the ride. Well, I have never found documentation to say that. I did find a letter from her grandson saying that Sybil did have letters from George Washington, but he never said what those letters said. All he said that those letters were precious to his grandmother. So I never said in my book. And now, already the very first person to quote my book, and the book wasn't even out yet, and she has my book in the bibliography, and she said that I said that George Washington went to congratulate her, which is not true. So it's a little disconcerting that already I'm being misquoted.
Well, how was she able to quote
I have
book
no idea. I didn't have the book. I don't know how she got it. But I think that what happened was some of the publishers put the book online, and they did pre-orders. And some of them gave sneak peeks into the book. And I'm sure she read some of those sneak peeks, but I'm telling you right now, none of those sneak peeks say that George Washington congratulated her, because that was one of the things that bothered me. Because you can't say, just like the horse named Star, I have no documentation that says her horse was named Star, yet it's repeated over and over and over again, just like the six children. And what happens is people just repeat articles over and over. The first paragraph written about Sybil was in the 1930s, and it said, after her famous ride, Sybil Ludington married her childhood sweetheart, Edward, or Edmund, or Henry, depending on the article, Ogden, who was a lawyer in Catskill, New York. She had six children, four boys and two girls. One of her children was a hero in Kansas. John, every one of those sentences is wrong. I have proved that every single one of those sentences is not true. So,
well, you have an opportunity not only with the book to correct this, but I mentioned earlier that you have a large number of events related to the book rollout. Please take us through some of the places that you'll be speaking in the next month and a half.
All right. April 2nd, I'll be at the Yorktown Town Board meeting, as you mentioned. April 5th, I'll be at the Antipedian Books in Garrison Landing at 6:30 p.m. April 6th, I'll be at the Putnam County History Museum in Cold Spring. April 7th, I'll be at Keeler Tavern Garden House in Ridgefield, Connecticut. April 10th, I will be doing a TV show with Armando Famiglietti at Comcast. April 12th, I'll be all the way up in Lake George at Fort William Henry, where her father fought and then returned home from to marry Sybil's mother. 20th, I'll be at Split Rock Books in Cold Spring. On April 24th, I'll be at the Kent Historical Society at Kent Cliffs on Route 301. April 28th, I'll be at Tompkins Corners Cultural Center on Peekskill Hollow Road. April 30th, I'll be at the Taconic Postcard Club in Yorktown on the second floor of the community building. May 8th and 9th, I'll be taking students from the Fulmer Road Elementary School on a Sybil Ludington bus tour. May 10th, I'll be at the Mayapack Middle School Career Day Fair. May 11th, I'll be at the Putnam Valley Historical Society at the Putnam Valley Library. May 15th, I'll be at the Northeast Westchester Rotary Club book launch. May 17th, I'll be at the Hudson Valley Writers, thanks to you, in Phillips Manor Station. May 23rd, I'll be at the Pauling Public Library. And then I have some October readings for my Hauntings book and my Sybil book at the Patterson Library, St. Paul's National Historic Site, and the Eastchester Tuckahoe Rotary. So I'm a busy man. And if you didn't write down everything I just said, simply go to my website.
Can they find this online?
Go on my website at www.vtdequino.com. And what will come up is it'll say DeQuino Events, and just click on Events, and these will all be there. And this is just the beginning. I know there's several more to come. And, John, I'm a man on a mission. Women have not gotten the shake they deserve, and Sybil certainly didn't. And there is no way that this woman is going to stay dead when there's a writer like me who's willing to make sure her story is told correctly. Now, I'm not going to say that every single thing in this book is perfectly true as it stands. It's true as I know it. In every single opportunity I had to correct the information, I've taken. Now, could it be that there's more out there? Yes, it could be. And I'm not going to stop looking. But I'm telling you that this book certainly is as comprehensive as I could possibly make it. I did not take any one fact without studying it.
I have a recommendation for you. I think that you should also have a song, The Ballad of Sybil Ludington. And I've discussed it with the songwriter who is going to work one up for your approval.
Wonderful. Love it.
Bob Zaslow has written a number of songs.
Well, that'd be wonderful. Another thing that I'm doing, and, you know, people say, well, now that I've heard your story, I don't need to come to your talks. Well, I am preparing a PowerPoint that will allow you to actually see the letters I've been talking about. And I will have them on the screen so that you could see her signature. You could see what I used to tell her story. Again, this is a document-based book. And if I
mentioned a number of times, your other book that's going to be talked about also in October. Tell us briefly about that book, and then we'll get back to this. The Hauntings book.
Yeah, I will be bringing those with me too. They happen to be by the same publisher. So I'll be bringing both those books. The Hauntings of the Hudson River Valley, that too is a story, a large part, is a story of a 16-year-old boy, again, a teenager, who was actually 17 when he was arrested and accused of shotgunning an 80-year-old man. And the story of the murder and the trial is horrendous. What they did to this boy is amazing. And they did hang him. And he was hanged behind the courthouse in Putnam County, the only person ever to be actually executed in Putnam County. Now, there were other people from Putnam County who got executed, but not there. So he was hanged right there. And it was horrendous. And all the details of that are in the book. And so that and stories about Smalley's Inn, which is in Carmel, and ghost sightings. That got me into the whole paranormal thing. So when I go to these talks, I'll actually be having two books, The Patriot Hero and Hauntings of the Hudson River. And both of them will be available. And I will, of course, be happy to autograph those for anyone interested. And my goal is to get as many people to read these books as possible, because both George Denny and Sybil have been slighted by history. Unfair. And they need to have their stories clear so that people understand who they were and the time that they lived. You know what? I just can't bear to believe that they're not at peace. I don't believe that they rest in peace. And until I get their story right, I can't rest in peace.
From all these book activities, calm down. What else is next for you?
Well, I probably am going to work on, for a short time in my life, I met the greatest man I've ever known, Roy Campanella, who was the Dodger catcher for Brooklyn Dodgers, 3-time MVP winner. He and I were best friends. I traveled with him all over. And I actually created 13 audio tapes sitting in his trophy room with him. My intention was to do a book at that time, but I was so busy being his friend that the book was never written. And those tapes sat for years. I'm now back with those tapes trying to create a book from them. And again, I need people to know who Roy Campanella really was. And I'll be able to present a book, I hope, with an audio tape that goes with the book, so that when you purchase the book, you could actually hear Roy telling his own story in his own words. And that's my...
For the audience who may not be familiar with baseball or the Brooklyn Dodgers, Roy Campanella came up to the Dodgers in the second wave of blacks. Jackie Robinson was the first. And
second wave. He was really the first wave, but Robinson was first, and then
Robinson, and they brought the pitcher up in 47 to room with him in the end of the year. Larry Doby became the first American League.
Right. And then Roy became the third.
He was a center fielder for the Cleveland Indians. Roy and Don Newcomb came up together, and Roy took
the place. And they were
actually
roomies.
Yeah, of Bruce Edwards, who had been the first string catcher in 1947. And Roy was there in the glory years of the Dodgers, even though that they did not win the World Series.
Except
to the Yankees.
For 1955, when Roy was the MVP and the Brooklyn Dodgers beat the Yankees. And
which,
it was...
Correct. But Johnny Padres pitched. Now, the problem was that Roy's career was cut short by the horrendous the motor accident.
Yeah, he broke his neck.
That left
he broke
a paraplegic.
And became a quadriplegic.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I knew him as a quadriplegic. And I used to physically lift him from his chair and put him in the front seat of my car and take him around. I used to sit at home with him. We watched television together and sometimes watched the golfers across the street from his house play golf. And I went to Mexico with him. I went to almost all of the All-Star and Old-Timers games. I was even out on the field with him. We were best friends. I lived like 3 miles from his house, maybe even less. I lived in Tarrytown, and he lived in White Plains on Fair Street off of 119. I lived right on 119. So a good friend of mine, a woman friend of mine, introduced me to him, and the four of us used to travel together. And again, we went everywhere. And I had the opportunity to know him as a man, not only as a great ball player, but I didn't even know him as a ball player. I was too young. And he came up about the year I was born. So it was like I didn't really know him, but I did know him later. He was already in his 50s. And I was only in my late 20s, and we just hit it off. And I told him I was an aspiring writer, and he said, all right, well then, let's get to work. And that's when I started taping him and talking to him about everything. We talked about his disability. We talked about baseball. We talked about his divorce, his remarriage, everything is on there. And I just, for a long time, just couldn't get myself to put it all together in a way that would help him be seen as the wonderful man he was. And I think, after all these years of letting those tapes sit, I think I'm ready to present the Roy Campanella that the world needs to know.
That would be wonderful, man.
Yeah, I I'm working on it now, so we'll see.
Oh, you also have to finish Jimmy Loves Mary, though, don't you?
Yeah. I have a young adult book that I really love. It's loosely based on my grandson's experiences. My grandson was on the wrestling team, and I was going up there every week to watch his matches. And I built a whole story on some of my experiences watching the matches and watching his coach. And then I created a fictional story all around that and combined it with my Mary Loved Daisies. And it's, in a sense, a prequel to my young adult novel, Mary Loved Daisies. And it's in that book begins with Mary's death. And now this new book, Mary's alive again. And it was wonderful to do because I knew both of those kids. And it was so wonderful to go back and see what they were like as kids. That's what I love about writing. You have the opportunity to see these books before anybody else does and to read them. And become involved in these lives of these kids. My characters are never characters; they're people, and their lives, And to put these lives together and to live these lives with these characters is just a wonderful experience. And that's the kind of thing I try to bring to my writers, to tell them what it would be like and then have them experience. You can't tell a writer that experience. A writer has to experience it for him or herself, to know what it's like to be in the heart and the soul and the mind of a character, so much so that the character comes to life.
That's a very good line. They're not characters, they're people.
We've
covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and certainly productive life. What else would you like the audience to know about Vinnie D'Aquino?
Only that I have a wonderful wife. I have a wonderful son and daughter and grandchildren. And my family is what keeps me alive and well and wanting to live. They've been wonderful support. My wife has been by my side from when this all began until now. She, you know, when you have a guy like me who's all over the place, it's a little hard to keep up sometimes. I think I have a little too much energy sometimes, but she understands. Sometimes she has to step aside and let me do what I have to do, but it's because of that support. And my kids have been good too, you know, and difficult because I, you know, you have to have a lot of balls in the air, you know, and you have to juggle your private life with your work, you know. For years I had to put bread on the table, and I wasn't able to get this involved in my writing until I retired in 2007. And then I was able to do a lot more. And that's when most of my books have been written. It was after I retired. Although Kiss the Candidates Goodbye and Hauntings and the first Sybil book, I was still working when those were written. But a lot of my young adult books came later.
Thank you very much, Vinnie. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, and I also might add that one of the other things that keeps me moving, friends like you, John. I appreciate your coming to the workshop every week and being the man you are. You are so dedicated. You deserve to be Poet Laureate. You are a spokesman for the art. And keep on doing what you do.
I hope to.
Good.
Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join us next week at the same time for my conversation with the talented poet M. Tofolo, who coincidentally is also an upcoming guest on One-on-One with Vin D'Aquino. Go to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com for the URLs of previous shows. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. And until next time, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see you. And let's go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
Thank you again, Vinnie, and good night, everybody.
Good night.